There's a fundamental disagreement going on in the house these days over whether I should be spending my time on two episodes a week or doing other things to grow the podcast. I figured two a week features more creators of nonfiction while possibly reaching twice the audience. The missus thinks I should be spending time on different kinds of promotion, advertising, etc., so that this thing can sustain itself. At the moment, we'll agree to disagree. Though she's probably right, she most likely is, she always is, but to her credit, she loves the riff. Seriously, I'm not even making that up. I even asked her when I bought this song, "You don't think it's too heavy, do you? Should I use more like AC/DC song?" Kind of like the one you hear at the end of the show. And she was like, "No, I like the heavy one." Oh, so there you go. Hey, you know the drill. It's the Creative Nonfiction Podcast, the show where I speak with leaders in the field of nonfiction about telling true stories, narrative journalists, doc filmmakers, essayists, and memoirists, and radio producerists, to tease out tactics, habits, and routines so you can apply those tools of mastery to your own work. I am Brendan O'Mara. Hey. If you don't already subscribe to the show, do it on Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music, Stitcher, and very soon Spotify. If the episode or episodes strike a chord, share it with your friends. You are the social network, not those other goons. Episode 98 features Lisa Romeo, at Lisa Romeo on Twitter, whose memoir Starting With Goodbye, a daughter's memoir of love after loss, tells the story of her late father and the continued relationship Lisa has with him in memory. It's not a downer. Lisa writes it with such great tact that you never feel weighed down. Quite the opposite, really. She talks about, in this episode, brain dumps, writing right away as a form of note-taking, even while close to the traumatic event, getting perspectives from people outside your genre, and the power of paper habits. It's pretty cool. Stay tuned to the end of the show for some incentivized call to action. Is that a word? Incentivized calls to action. There you go. For now, let's hear from Lisa Romeo. Hey, this is kind of cool that we have a connection over horses.
Yeah, that's where I started writing because when I was a little girl, I wanted my father to buy me a pony. And then I grew too tall for a pony. So then, of course, I wanted a horse. But I kept writing all these stories about a little girl who finally got her horse. And it worked. I got the horse when I was 14. And then I went on and wrote for horse magazines. And that's how I got my start.
Well, what do you think it is about the horse that elicits such almost like this primal need for storytelling? It really lends itself, that animal lends itself to story in a lot of ways.
Oh, absolutely. I don't know what it is, and I'm not sure I want to know what it is. I think it's something a little mystical and mysterious, and I always thought it was limited to little girls, and then, of course, I grew up and found out, no, it's not little girls. It's grown-up people, too, who yearn to tell stories about horses. I don't know, but it's wonderful, and I hope I don't ever outgrow it.
Yeah, they're so supremely athletic. You know, they're the biggest and sort of fastest animal for how big they are in the world. One of them for sure. I'm sure there are some others that are as big and as right. fast, but the sort of the grace and the athleticism of them is like unmatched, really. And it's just that you can see it in any discipline, whether it's hunter jumpers or on the racetrack.
And that partnership, I mean, you can share in that. You can ride the horses and be with them and live with them and take care of them. And they take care of us in a lot of emotional ways, I think, when you are involved with horses.
Yeah, when my sister was little, I want to say maybe preteen or so, she used to help take care of a friend's horse. And she would ride the horse, exercise it. And I guess she was riding along a creek one time and she got thrown from the horse and fell into the creek. And she was underwater and partially unconscious, kind of woozy, and then she felt herself getting pulled out of the water, and it was her horse pulling her out of the water who effectively saved her life.
Oh, I love that story.
Yeah, so you talk about that kinship. It truly goes both ways.
Absolutely. Yeah, I miss them. It's been a long time since I've written, and I do miss it.
And so with with respect to horses, clearly they kind of gave you the writing bug, so to speak. So when you were little, was writing something you always wanted to aspire to?
Yeah, I was. I grew up in the 1960s in suburban New Jersey, and I guess at that time, nursery school was sort of a novel thing. It wasn't an expected thing that every toddler went off to nursery school. And I begged and begged. I wanted to go to school because my brother was 8 years older than me. My sister was 12 years older than me. So I saw them going off to school all the time, and I just begged, please send me to nursery school. And my parents wouldn't. And my sister taught me to read and write when I was about 4.5, 5 years old. And that was it. That just opened the world to me. And from then on, all I wanted to do was read and write. And I got a little typewriter when I was 5, and that was it. Books were everything. I just would come home with piles of books. We had this tiny little library in my little suburb, and I remember putting a pile of books on the counter. And the woman behind the counter would say, "You can't read all those in 2 weeks, dear." And I'd just say, "Yeah, well, that's okay. Please, can I have them?" And I'd go home and read them all. And my father was always reading. He read 2 or 3 newspapers a day. My mother read magazines, and she wrote letters. My mother wrote every night. She would sit at the dining room table, and she would write letters to friends and relatives who had moved all over the world. And to me, words were everything. They were how you communicated and told stories. And so that's when it bit me, I guess, very young.
And given how much older or how much younger you were than your siblings, writing and writing stories was probably a way for you to almost find some kinship with the language, because they have their friends and everything, and they probably weren't super willing to like grab Lisa and tug her along. You probably found a kinship with the stories because they were off doing their own thing, I imagine.
Well, my brother certainly didn't want me tagging along, even though I did. But my sister, she was like a second mother to me. She just did everything with me, took me everywhere, let me go with her, and she coddled me, and we had this great bond right from the beginning. And when she went off to college, I was only 5.5, just going into kindergarten, and I was completely devastated that she left. And so I'd sit at the dining room table next to my mother at night in this little typewriter and type her letters almost every night, and my mother would mail them off to her.
And so when you were coming up through, say, high school and college, did you still want to, what kind of a writer did you want to be at that point?
I wanted to be a sports writer when I was in high school. My big dream was to be a sports writer for the New York Times. Mm. My brother and my father had season tickets to the New York Giants and to the New York Rangers. So from a young age, I was going to professional football games, professional hockey games. And I remember very clearly there was a woman. Well, I didn't know she was a woman. There was a writer for the New York Times named Robin Herman who covered the Rangers. And in high school, my journalism class took a field trip to the New York Times building. And they were taking us through the building, and I saw the sports department off in the distance, and we weren't really going to go there. So I broke away with my friend. She and I were like Lucy and Ethel. So we broke away from the trip, and we went to find the sports department. And it was so exciting. We walked in, and there was Red Smith and all these other people. And I said to someone, "I want to meet Robin Herman. Where's Robin Herman?" And someone pointed to a desk, and there was a woman sitting there. And it didn't occur to me she was a woman. And to me, that just opened all the floodgates. I thought, oh my gosh, I could be a sports writer. So that's what I wanted to be through most of high school, probably all of high school and part of college. And I did write some sports, hockey and some other things, and of course, all the equestrian sports. But then as I went through college, I realized, well, maybe I don't want to be a full-time sports writer at a major newspaper. But it was a lovely dream for a while.
So what was that, maybe a moment or an inflection point where that change, where you pivoted from wanting to be a you know, sort of a beat sports writer to something else?
Well, I think the next thing that occurred to me was to write about horses, because I had horses by then. I had a couple of horses by then, and I wanted to go out on the horse show circuit right after college for a couple of years and just concentrate on my riding and competing. And one way to do that, I thought, was to write for all the equestrian magazines as a freelancer. And of course, Dad was paying the bills for the horses. There was no way I could have paid those kinds of bills for the training and the transportation and the horse show fees and veterinary bills. But I was working for all the equestrian magazines, and then I started doing publicity for equestrian events. So I was buying my food and my clothing and putting gas in the car and things like that, which you could do in the early 80s on freelance income. I'm not sure you could do it today. But so that was, you know, I wanted to write for the Chronicle of the Horse was my big dream for a while. And I was a regular columnist there. So for about 3-4 years, I traveled around on the horse show circuit, first on the West Coast, then back on the East Coast. And that's what I did. And that was, and then I translated that into my first full-time job away from the horse show circuit was working for a public relations firm. It was 1984. The Olympics were coming up in Los Angeles. And this firm's client, Purina, was sponsoring the equestrian team, and they needed somebody who spoke the language. So I was very lucky to get that job and started working in PR.
Did working in PR feel kind of like weird and disjointed after having kind of been on sort of the other side of the fence doing some journalism? What was that like?
Well, for the first year, I was mostly working on that equestrian campaign, so it didn't feel like that big of a switch. I was talking to the same editors, interviewing the same riders and whatnot. But then, of course, I had to work on other PR accounts for the agency. So then I was working on things like, you know, Sharp Electronics and other consumer manufacturing goods and whatnot. And that's when I started to feel like, yeah, but you know what? This isn't really writing. This isn't really journalism. But it paid really well.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you're in your mid-20s, you want to start making some money. And I thought, okay, I could go back to pure writing, you know, one day. I think I stayed in PR about 10 years. First, I worked for two different agencies, and then I had my own small PR business. And by the time I had my own small PR business, I had decided I just wanted to work for nonprofit organizations, which I did. And then eventually I wanted to just get back to the pure writing.
That must have been neat for your father to hear, like when you kind of struck out on your own, because he had, after reading the book, you know, he had like an entrepreneurial bent and, you know, running that polyester fabric business and being a very successful business owner. And so when you hung up your own PR shingle, he must have been pretty proud at that moment.
I think he was. Yeah, I really do think so. And he often would, when we'd have, you know, they lived far away from me, of course, by then. They were living in Las Vegas. By then I was still in New Jersey. But when we did see each other, one of the first things he would ask me about is, got any new clients? And then, of course, he knew no boundaries when it came to asking questions. So he would say, and how much are you charging them? And are you sure you're charging them enough? And don't you think you should raise your prices? And so on the one hand, that was great. He was such a great cheerleader. And on the other hand, I thought, you know, I can't be always answering to you about the money and all of that. And, you know, partly his was a scrappier industry where they, you know, made deals on handshakes and winks of the eye and whatnot. And, you know, PR isn't like that. You know, you write a whole prospectus for your client about how you're going to implement their program. And it's X number of dollars per month based on X number of hours. And so, you know, there was always this little tug between us, like, well, you don't really understand my business. And, you know, but he was always in my corner in that way. And I learned so many things just from having listened to him over the years talk about how he would negotiate and how he would approach a client and, you know, figuring out what's the sweet spot with this particular client. And And then I carried that over later, of course, when I was doing so much freelancing for, you know, dealing with editors and whatnot.
Yeah, that dovetails, that segues perfectly into what I wanted to ask you next. Like, being a freelancer, it's a lot of people, artists or writers, tend to want to be more on the generative sort of creative side of things, and often neglect or just turn a blind eye because they don't want to really face the business administration part of it. And when you're a freelancer, you're the CEO and the foot and sort of the foot soldier at the same time. So what did, you know, having an entrepreneurial spirit and father, what did you learn business-wise that you were able to translate into your freelancing?
The primary thing, I suppose, is that to remember always that your time and your output, your product, has a value. So not to want something so much that you're willing to give it away. Now, this is a funny and interesting thing because, of course, in the creative writing world, especially if we're talking about literary journals and that sort of thing, we're often not getting paid for some of the work we're giving away. There's reasons for that. You know, maybe you're building toward a book, and so you're writing essays in the meantime for literary journals, and there's a reason, and it makes sense to you to have it appear in those pages and be read by those people who read those kinds of things. But on the flip side, if you're working for magazines and newspapers and websites that are, you know, selling advertising against their editorial content, then you want to be paid for your work. And so I always have that in the back of my head from my father, like, make sure they pay you what you're worth. And, you know, you don't always have a lot of negotiating room today. I find contracts now are very restrictive and they want all the rights to everything forever. You know, they're written by lawyers, these contracts. And sometimes, I mean, my father used to tell me sometimes, just cross the thing out on the contract. No one will ever notice. You know, this is when we had paper contracts. Just draw a line through it and put your initial in the margin. And chances are they won't notice. And then that's legally binding. And he was right. But you can't always do that, you know, today on the electronic contracts. And they do notice. Your work does have value. And I guess you have to decide for yourself first. You know, what am I doing this particular piece for? Is this particular piece to earn a paycheck? Or is this particular piece going to serve me in some other way in pursuit of some other literary goal? And then it's perhaps worth not having a paycheck.
It's you almost have to hold a board meeting inside your head and be like, all right, guys, let's set up a pros and cons list. What are we going to do here? You know, what's the value, like you were saying?
Oh, that's exactly it. I never heard it put that way. You hold a board meeting inside your head, right?
In terms of some crafty type things, how you approach the work at hand, I wonder, when do you tend to get going in terms of the morning routine, and how do you set up your day and check in with yourself so you can have what you deem a productive and successful day at the ledger, so to speak?
Well, it varies a lot because I do teach in an MFA program, mm-hmm. and that which is an all online MFA program at Bay Path University. And I also sometimes teach at local colleges on campus. So it kind of depends what each semester looks like. But because I have teaching obligations and I very often have editing clients where I'm editing either their whole manuscript or just short pieces, the day really starts with checking in. Are any students looking for me? Does anybody have a question? Have I gotten submissions in from students or clients overnight that I need to then read or print out and look at and make notes on and, you know, give them electronic feedback on their document? So most days, the early part of the day up till noon at least is devoted to paid work, you know, just like anybody else. I have a job, several jobs. And then, of course, if I have any articles that I've been asked to write, I have deadlines coming up, those have to be done first. Anything that's related to a paycheck has to get done first. And I have two kids in college and my husband's self-employed as well. So that has to be attended to first. That's the day job. And then there's the personal writing, and I have to fit it in just like anybody else who has a job. Now, I'm lucky because most of the time I get to work at home, which means I can move things around in my day. And now that our children are older, we don't have to have set dinner time at 5:30. And so I can, you know, say, hey, I'm going to work till 9 o'clock tonight, and the household can go on without me. And I tend to like that. I like to spread out throughout the day and not feel like 5:30 everything has to end. So I will work in blocks. I'll do 3 or 4 hours of student work or 3 or 4 hours of client work, and then 3 or 4 hours, hopefully, of my own creative work. It doesn't always happen every day. But I do have that ability because I can sort of manipulate my own schedule, where there are days where I say, okay, today's just a writing day. Everything else has to wait till tomorrow.
Hmm. How do you keep your energy level at such a way that you can maintain a certain level of focus through, and to give each of those tasks the energy it deserves?
I don't know. I don't sleep a lot. So, so you can find me sometimes at the keyboard at 2 a.m. and I'm awake. So I don't know if that's a curse or a blessing. Most of the time, I think it's a blessing. And I'm also sort of boring. I don't have a lot of hobbies and things like that. So I don't need to spend the whole weekend playing tennis or tending to the garden. I'm just here in the office. I don't know. I'm not a yoga person, so I can't say, oh, my yoga keeps me energized or that sort of thing. I just thrive on work.
Mm-hmm. And what do you feel most engaged in, the writing part or the editing, rewriting part?
Of my own work, you mean? Well, first of all, I love the phase where I just call like a brain dump, you know, where I just get everything out of my head and onto the document on my computer screen or in a notebook, get it all out, all the stray thoughts I have on this topic that I'm going to write about. Just dump it all out, and it's totally messy, a horrible, crappy, it's not even a draft at that point. It might just look like a list. But I really like that moment because I feel like, okay, now I'm going to start on something. Now, because it's been like accumulating or simmering in my head or in my writer's notebook before then. And so then when I reach the point where I think, okay, I think I'm going to have something here, I love that moment. And then the rest is like torture. Until I get to where I have what I think is a pretty solid first draft, and it may have taken, you know, 10 tries from that moment of brain dump. But then when I have something that feels kind of solid, then I start revisions. And I'm one of these weird people who really love revision, because to me, that's where the work actually comes alive, is in revision. That's where I figure out what it is that I'm actually trying to say. Mm-hmm. So I love that phase.
Yeah, I love taking the chainsaw to it and just like blasting off pages at a time. Like, I love at that point, you've got your, the sort of the ore, and then you just start lopping off. I love just deleting 5 pages and seeing if it still reads the same and be like, oh,
exactly. It's the best. And I love paper, so I love to print things out, and then I get that red pen and just start drawing X's through things, mm-hmm. and it's so liberating.
It's so, I think, Lisa, what you were saying there with paper and, you know, the red marker, I think that's so important because you need to see where the deletions are happening. With the, you know, with deleting things through Microsoft Word or Scrivener or whatever program people use, it's just when it's gone, it's gone. It's like putting a to-do list on a dry erase board and then you erase it. It's like you can't see that it was done. You don't know it was there. So
that's right.
Yeah, so
you have to see the line through that thing on the to-do list. I love printing things out.
Yeah, I think that's so important because it does show what was previously there. And, you know, when you do that, you won't make the same mistake again, and you can actually see that work was done and not just believe that it was done because, you know, you put some time in. I don't know. I believe that you really kind of need to see it.
Well, not only that, but when it only exists on your computer screen, you're sort of carrying it around in your head. It's like a mental load, too. Mm. Whereas once you print it out, it exists as its own entity, so to speak. And I love to take the pages off the printer and then get the hell out of the office and go sit on the patio or at the dining room table or something, you know, with a cup of tea and try and engage with what I've written. It's hard because you can't be objective. It's your own work. But as much as you can try to engage as a reader, you know, like, does this make any sense? Would anyone want to read this? And that's where you see those problems that you do have to just X out. But the other great advantage of having it on paper is when we're talking about a big work, you know, a very, very long essay or short story or something, or a book manuscript, if you can clear a spot on the hugest table you can possibly find, or you can sit on the floor, let's say, and spread things all out around you, either sections or chapters or whatever, then you can start physically moving them around and you can really play with and get a sense of what's a good order here. You know, should I move the story from chapter 5 up to the beginning? And that makes for a lot of creative breakthroughs. Mm. And I find that that's being lost on a lot of younger writers who don't have that paper habit. They just, for whatever reason, I mean, I have a kid in college who tells me, Mom, if I had to print everything out, I'd be constantly running over to the print center and you're only allowed X, you know, 100 pages per semester. And then they start charging you for it. You know, so that's awful. I think. Yeah. So that's why we bought him a printer to have in his room.
Yeah.
He said, you're going to have a printer in your room and you're going to print your work out. but I think it's being lost and that's really too bad. And I encourage everyone I work with to print their work out.
With respect to some longer essays, maybe even the book you just wrote, did you employ that of printing out these massive amounts of pages and then laying them out and seeing where you can sort of massage the story and move things around? Like, did you have that experience recently?
Absolutely. I did that many, many times. In fact, there's a picture over on my website of the stack of manuscripts. And I started printing them out in different colors for every version. Uh-huh. I think there's 10 or 11 drafts in that photograph. And there's a purple stack, a yellow stack, a pink stack. yeah, I did that a lot. And I think it helped me a tremendous amount.
You know, what were some of those early manifestations of that? And how did it change? And how did it, like, how helpful was it to, I don't know, just to see those changes over time? You know, what did it look like before? And then maybe what was its transitionary phases like?
Well, the genesis of this book is that it started out as a whole bunch of essays. I was writing all these essays about grief and my father and my life at the time, and they were getting published. And at first I thought, oh, this is going to be like a linked themed essay collection. And so I put them all together in what I thought was a pleasing order. But the feedback I got both from publishers and from some respected authors who I asked to read it was, you know what, these are all fine on their own, but it would be better if you tried this as a traditional linear manuscript memoir. And I was very resistant to that. I didn't want to do that. I thought, I know best. Ha ha ha. But I also didn't know if I could. You know, part of it was a little bit of fear. Like, can I write that more traditional full narrative arc from beginning to end? You know, 80,000 words, I'm not sure. So the first thing I did when I decided to do that was I took all the essays, I printed them all out, and I sat down on the floor, and I had maybe 5 different color highlighter pens. And I went through them all and I assigned each different color like a theme. You know, these are dad's younger life. Yellow is dad's younger life. And pink is my life as a child and teenager. And green is when I was an adult and had my own children and was interacting with my father. So I highlighted these parts of all these essays. And then I did what we did when I was in college and went to journalism school. I got a pair of scissors and a big roll of tape, and I started cutting them up. So I cut them all up, and I stacked all the green highlighted stuff here and all the pink highlighted stuff here. And then I started taping everything together in what seemed like a pleasing, sensible order. So I taped all that stuff together, and some weren't together. Some had to be in different places because they had to do with different time frames or whatever. And so at the end, I had this enormous roll. It was all one piece, and it was like, you know, rolled up. And I lived with that for a couple of weeks to try and figure out what I could learn from that and, you know, what that was trying to tell me and whether it made sense or not. So by then, you know, all the essays were in shreds and I started thinking of it more like, you know, kindling. And then the thing that kind of pushed me over the edge that I thought, okay, now I can do this was I came up with a bookend, a beginning and the end of the chronology of what the book would cover. And once I decided on that, I decided I would start 2 or 3 months before Dad died when he had a stroke in the summer. And then it would end about 2.5 to 3 years after he died. So once I knew that, that's when everything seemed to suggest that it would fall into place, that I knew how I could progress and could draw that narrative arc. And there's a lot of moving around in the book. There's, as you know, that we move around in time here and there, and there's a bunch of flashbacks and whatnot, but we're basically progressing over that 2.5 to 3 year period. And that was the tipping point for me. Once I figured out, okay, that's the bookends. Now I can put everything inside of that. And then I wrote a tremendous amount of connecting material between all of those pieces I had salvaged from the essays.
That's so important about the, I think it's, if you can figure out your, the sooner you can figure out your ending, I think the stronger, the longer pieces will be, because I kind of equate it to being a, like a lighthouse in the distance. Like you have a target that you can then sort of write towards or sail towards. And that, at what point did the ending become very apparent to you in this process? And like you kind of alluded to it already, but how much easier did that make the actual writing process once you had a target to aim at?
Oh, absolutely. I sat down in, it was in January of 2016. I had taken myself to a very remote part of Maine, to a bed and breakfast that was very inexpensive. And nobody goes there in January, 17 degrees below zero most days. I was there because my son was doing an internship up there at the National Weather Service. And I wanted to be nearby for a week. And I was between semesters. So I thought, great, this is going to be like a self-imposed writing retreat for myself. Anyway, so that's when I figured out the chronology. And I wrote the ending right away. That was probably the first thing I wrote was I knew exactly what scene I wanted to end on. And that helped a lot to know I was writing toward that.
Yeah, that's perfect. Is that something you, that through now having experienced the sort of the power of that, do you lay that in front of your students too and be like, you know, not that I want to impose too much, but if you can figure out your ending, the sooner the better, right?
Yeah, exactly. Even if it turns out later on that it's not the actual ending, maybe it's just going to be a placeholder ending, it gives people some confidence that they're actually going to finish, because the biggest problem I see with students I work with, no matter what the skill level, no matter what they're writing, is that they worry they won't finish it. And very often they don't finish. So it's such an important skill and experience for a writer to know that they will finish, that they're going to write something and finish it. That doesn't mean it's fabulous, but it does mean that they went through the entire experience of writing beginning, middle, end, and finishing it. So very often I will say to a student, just write 2 paragraphs that you think could be the last paragraphs of this piece. Where do you want a reader to end? With your thinking right now, having not written the whole thing yet, where do you think you could end? And that becomes very helpful to some students.
And given that the nature of memoirs, sometimes people want to, something happens, something traumatic happens, and there is an itch or an urge to write about it and try to make something of it when you're too close to ground zero. And I wonder with this particular story that you wrote about, with your father passing away, when did you finally feel ready to tackle a bigger project? And after that had gestated long enough, you know, how are you processing that?
You know, this is a question I actually have trouble with, because I feel two ways about this. Number one, I began writing about the experience of the grief and my father dying the week he died. I mean, as soon as I flew out to my mother's house, I was there within less than 24 or 36 hours after he had passed away. And that night I was in my bedroom, you know, in my notebook writing. So now that's not necessarily writing that's going to be published, but I started right away. So I think there's a value in capturing the feeling, the intensity of the emotion as it's happening. But then, of course, I'm a much bigger fan of letting time go by and processing something and then writing about it with some maturity and some perspective. So really, you know, I think if you could do both, if you can do some of the writing while something's happening, but maybe not rush that out to be published, maybe just let that sit and you know, exist for you, and maybe you'll use some of it eventually and maybe you won't. So I don't think there's a hard and fast rule about that. And every time I do, I violate it myself.
I think that's a really great approach, is that even if something of this nature or anything that's just traumatic and feels important to the beholder, that maybe even right in the mix of it, at least taking those notes or journaling on it just to have a record of it, so that maybe in a year or 2 years or 5 years down the road, you can then reference that, because your memory is going to, things are going to change, and the way you see or the way you remember it will certainly change. But if you have a record from early on, you can play those two off each other, how you were feeling then, how you're feeling now, but then you will have like a concrete record of it earlier. So it's like, you know, you're planting seeds of research like on day zero that you're going to use on day 1000 or something.
Absolutely. You said it so exactly. And there's a tiny little example. When I was sitting with my father in the hospital and he was dozing on and off, I was taking some notes and I kept writing down that the nurses kept walking in and they all had different color Crocs on. I don't know if you remember those.
Oh, yeah.
Sort of plastic clogs. This was, you know, 10, 11 years ago. And, you know, after a while, I didn't even have to glance up. I could just, you know that the yellow Crocs walked in, so that was nurse so-and-so. And I never wound up using that in anything I wrote, but I remember going back and finding that in my notes. And just that visual and the sound I had described that the Crocs made on the linoleum floor, just that kind of transported me back to being in that room at that time. Mm-hmm. So notes when something's happening can help you in a way you have no way of predicting down the line.
Yeah, it's a great exercise that I had used in college when I had the great Madeline Blaze as a teacher in a memoir class. And she had us like lay out a timeline and just, you know, just putting little memories of some along that timeline. And then it's overwhelming to look at it first, but then when you put down like one little thing, that is a lead domino that leads to another memory, and then maybe you go then and do some research and go talk to those people involved. And then all of a sudden this thing starts filling out. So it kind of like the Crocs thing, though you didn't use it, maybe that was a domino that led to something else that made its way into the book.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It did. Capturing those details in the moment might help you down the line when you're writing who knows what.
And so after you had sort of taped together all these highlighted pages, and how did you go about filling in the connective tissue between them so it did feel seamless instead of kind of chunky, if that makes any sense?
Well, one thing I did was go back to my writer's notebooks. I always have just a plain cheap spiral notebook going that I write in longhand. And so it had been almost 8 or 10 years, I guess 8 or years or so, between the time my father died and when I was actually writing the manuscript that now became the book, I had been writing in my notebook for years on related topics and themes. And sometimes it was just a paragraph. Sometimes it was 4 or 5 pages of handwriting. I never knew where it was going to go, but I knew it was connected to my father's story. So the first thing I did was went through all these notebooks to find all the stuff I had written over the years. And a lot of that found its way into the book. And then I had been collecting stuff I had torn out of magazines and books where I had sticky notes all over the place that raised thoughts or ideas and themes I wanted to explore in the book. So that was helpful. I started, you know, looking through all those and thinking about how is this connected to my story and why did I tear this out? And, oh, yeah, this makes me think I want to write about X. So that was really helpful. I had like a, you know, those bins you put your Christmas decorations in your attic. I had one of those bins filled with stuff. So, you know, it had been percolating a long time. And I guess I knew someday I would do something with all of this material. And so then I started to do something with it. And the rest of it was just very patiently going through and looking for opportunities to tell more small stories and explore more ways in which this narrator, you know, went through this experience that hadn't already been explored in what was already there. And in a way, that was wonderful because it let me tell some stories I hadn't even thought of telling that really brought my father to life from, you know, his earlier days and from when I was younger that had never made their way into any of the original essays. So that was kind of fun, actually.
How did you keep all the research straight and organized? And how were you able to access it so you could, you know, write about it and, you know, not be like scrambling all over the place? Like, where was that? Where is that piece of paper or that interview or that anecdote? So,
What makes you think I wasn't scrambling all over the place? Actually, if you were sitting in my office right now with me, you'd see that original bin still under my writing table.
Nice.
And I would go through fits and starts where I'd get very organized and I'd get out the file folders and I'd start labeling everything and putting things together, grouping things together. And that would last a little while, and then I would just go back to the big heap of stuff. So it really depended, I don't know, on my mood or how much time I had available. But I guess, you know, you at least I like develop a sense of, I know where that is. It's just going to take me a minute to find it. And there it was. I tend to be a pack rat. So if I've printed something out or I've torn something out of a newspaper or magazine or whatever, I still have it.
It sounds like you were able to apply a certain journalistic sense or taste or approach to telling the story. Like you had certain stories and you were able to kind of, for lack of a better term, sort of like dispassionately go back to the source material and maybe interview people and try to build that scene up, build scenes up the way a reporter would. And how important is that for someone writing a personal story to try to be detached in a sense and be a reporter on their own life?
Well, I think you have to be able to look at parts of what you're writing, parts of the story, and ask yourself, well, what is that really about? I mean, sometimes there's charming little stories we have about our life or about another person in our life, but they're really only good for, you know, the dining room table after Thanksgiving dinner. They don't really translate into, you know, the piece of memoir. So you kind of really have to look at it and say, well, is that just lovely or funny or horrible sounding to me because it happened to me and I was there? Or does it have any value for a reader? So you have to figure out what's it really about? What's the underlying theme? What's the message here? And sometimes you write some of that stuff because you think, yes, this is important. And this shows a certain quality of my father, or it shows a certain dynamic in our family. And it's really going to get the point across. And you write it all up and you're trying to, you know, put it into the memoir. And then after a while you think, you know what? it's too thin or it's too idiosyncratic. I'd have to do so much backstory to make it make any sense. And so then you dump it. So you don't always know when you're in the midst of writing it, which is why, as we talked before, you wind up with, you know, red X's through a lot of stuff. But you have to go through that. You know, you have to write all that stuff to figure out which is the material that's going to make the cut. As far as like researching, in terms of talking to other people, I would talk to my sister being so much older than me, 12 years older than me, she really grew up in a different family. What's that expression? You know, every sibling grows up in a different family.
Yeah.
And my parents' financial situation was so different when she was growing up. They were struggling. They were living in a two-family house on reduced rent because it was his sister's house. And then right along when I was born was my father's fortunes exploded. And so we moved to a house in the suburbs and, you know, he was just starting to really make money. And by that time, you know, my sister's in high school and then college, and she didn't really reap a lot of that where I did. I had the horses and the travel and all of that. So it was important at various points along the way that I go to my sister and say, you know, here I'm writing about when mommy and daddy were younger. And what do you think? Have I got it right? Do you remember any of this? And she was invaluable for fact checking, that sort of thing.
Was there any resentment between her and you because you grew up with different, essentially different childhoods and different parents and circumstances?
Oh, yeah, I think so. I mean, not now, of course, we're old and mature now, but I kind of remember feeling that way when I was, especially when I was in my early 20s and I was traveling on the horse show circuit and dad was paying all those travel and horse bills. And yeah, I was working and making paychecks, but I didn't have to have a full-time job and pay rent and that sort of thing. And, you know, she had gone to college, become a teacher, started teaching immediately right out of college. And she's always and still is a very independent person. And I think, you know, there was some resentment there when it looked easy for me, and it was, you know, and then I transitioned into that PR job in Manhattan that paid well. And so I think there was like a rocky period. We don't really talk about it now. But I think there was a period where she thought, oh, sure, the golden child's getting everything she wants.
And to a point you were making earlier about what to maybe leave in or leave out, who are you trusting with that material? Because, of course, you're a little close to it, so maybe something that feels important to you might not be germane to the story at large. So do you have a trusted reader that can say, oh, Lisa, this has to go, or Lisa, this needs to be more inflated?
A bunch of different people, actually. Not, I know some writers will say, oh, there's one person who I always exchange work with. But I don't really have that particular situation. But there were a couple people that I trusted. Christina Baker Klein, who's a New York Times bestselling novelist, a friend of mine. She lives nearby. She saw the manuscript at various stages and she gave me lots of really great advice. Lorraine Herring, who is a novelist and runs a writing program at another college. She writes magical realism and it was really fun. We exchanged manuscripts at one point and I thought, okay, this is way out of your comfort zone. It's memoir. And she gave me her magical realism novel. And I thought, well, this isn't anything like I write. And it was so much fun to work on each other's manuscripts. And then, of course, I have all those quote unquote conversations with my father after he's dead. So Lorraine had a lot of fun telling me, what do you mean you don't write magical realism? But I think it's great to get perspective from people who don't write exactly what you write. You know, yes, I have friends, lots of friends who write memoir, and there were times at which I exchanged chapters or pieces with some of the book with some of them, and that's wonderful. But I really think it's great to get perspective of people who write something else and have great sense of story and narrative. That's what I was looking for when I was trying to write the whole manuscript, because I hadn't ever written something, I hadn't ever written, you know, a linear arc that 80,000 words yet. So I really wanted to hear from people who had done that a number of times.
When you were writing the story and maybe just writing in general, what is your capacity for writing in a given time period? Or a better way of putting that is, how long in terms of time can you sit there and write before you get kind of tired and you have to quit?
Well, I usually don't get a chance to get to that point because something else has to be done.
Yeah.
So typically, I think any session doesn't go much beyond 3.5 hours, something like that. However, I'm really great at sticking to something. And if I can block things out and nothing else is due and no one's looking for me, like I did in 2016 when I went up to Maine, I sat down at 6:37 in the morning and I did not get up and leave that project until probably 6:37 in the evening. And I did that for 7 days in a row. So I can do both. Preference, of course, is, just a couple hours, because especially with memoir, if you're writing about anything that's bringing up, those family memories, and if it borders on anything sad or whatever, you need a mental break.
Mm. Was this book really hard for you to write?
No. Well, hard in a sense, like from a writing perspective, a writing challenge. Yeah, it took me like 7 years to get to the point where I thought, okay, I'll try and do what everybody's telling me to do and write the normal traditional memoir. That was a big obstacle. I was very pigheaded about it. I feel like I'm an essayist at heart, and that's my big dream, was the first book I wanted to be an essay collection. So it was hard to get over that fact. So getting to the point where I could say, okay, I'm going to tackle this particular writing challenge, that was the hard part. Once I started, then it wasn't hard anymore. Then it was interesting and trying to figure out how to do it, because that's a great kind of a fun challenge. In terms of like the material, emotionally, I wouldn't say it was hard, because I mean, that's what I do. I write about, I try and untangle the emotions on the page. And to me, that's not hard. That's interesting.
How did you approach the inevitable self-doubt in the middle of the process when maybe you're like, ah, this is junk. No one's going to ever want to read this, coupled with, I got to finish it. I like to call it the ugly middles of the drafts. And so how did you process that while you were, just wondering if it was even worth it?
Well, I think I did a lot of that in all the time I was procrastinating and avoiding writing that final linear manuscript. I think I got all that out of my system before that, because I sat down in January 2016 to do that. And at the end of April, I was done. It had been read by other people, and I started sending it out. So it went very fast at that point, four and a half months. But there were 5 years before that of thinking it through. Thinking is undervalued in a sense. Like, we don't account, as writers, we don't really account for all the time that we think about a project while it's marinating on that back burner in our brain. And if you're lucky and if you've paid enough attention to that, you've worked out so many narrative problems already, just because you were thought about it deeply enough.
Mm. What would you say you learned about yourself as an artist and a writer over the course of writing the essays and then the book itself?
Oh, boy. Well, I guess I learned that I could do a lot more things than I thought I could. So that was wonderful.
It really stretched your boundaries in a sense.
Yeah. That was great. I mean, to the point where now I think, what shall I write next? And I feel like the options are totally open to me. Like, if I want to write a novel, maybe I can try that. And, if I want to write a reported nonfiction book, maybe I can try that. I'm not saying I'm going to succeed at all of those things, but I think it moved me to a point where I have more confidence in my experience and in, you know, just knowing that I could tackle a project and see it through, even if it's not similar to what I've done before. And to me, that feels great, you know, as a writer, to know that, you know, okay, I did it. And now what's next? And I don't know what's next. It's a little scary not to know, but I'll figure it out.
And would you have been happy, or would it have been satisfying enough to merely have written this book for yourself, independent of it being published? Or did you need to see it published to get the greatest satisfaction out of having made the book?
Nah, you know, I'm not one of those people who say, oh, it's okay if it stays in my computer or if I just have it in my office and know I wrote it. No, I'm sorry. We write for readers. I mean, really, we want people to read what we wrote. That's how I feel. Well, that's what makes a writer tick to me anyway. Yeah, sure. There's plenty of stuff sitting here in my office. I don't care if anybody reads. There's poems and there's short stories that I don't feel real confident about. They were really fun to write. But this is something I wrote in order to see it as a book and have people hopefully read it and maybe hopefully get something from it.
And what was the process like of shopping your manuscript around? And yeah, how many times was it rejected? And then what was that moment like when it was finally taken on?
I didn't count the number of rejections. I'm sort of glad I didn't count that. But, you know, I was sending it around. I did not have an agent. I was sending it around to traditional small literary presses that would work with authors who do not have agents. And that's kind of a slow process sometimes because these are small organizations with small staff. So it takes them a long time to get through the submissions. But I had, so from end of April, from May of 2016, through to like January, February of 2017. So for about 6 or 7 months, it had been circulating around. And 4 different publishers at that point were reading the full manuscript in February of 2017. So I was feeling good that, you know, maybe one of those 4 would turn into, because, you know, you submit it and you submit a query and then they say, oh, send a chapter or two. And then if they like that, oh, send the whole manuscript, which doesn't happen often. So I had, it was out at 4 places then. And I went to AWP Writers Conference in Washington, D.C. in February of 2017. I kind of went on a whim. I wasn't going to go. There was this big snowstorm. I live in New Jersey. And I noticed on Facebook, all these writers were saying, oh, I'm not going. I had to cancel. My flight got canceled. And I thought, eh, maybe I'll go. Just, I have 4-wheel drive. I used to live in Syracuse. I don't mind driving in the snow. It's only 4 hours to Washington. So I went down and I kind of didn't have this agenda in my head. Usually when I go to a conference, I have this list, this very rigid list of I must meet this person and I want to pitch this editor. And I just kind of went like, oh, let me just go see my writing friends and sit in and listen onto a few sessions. And I was walking around what they call the book fair, which is where all the publishers and journals have their booths. And it was kind of maybe a half hour or so before closing up on the last day of the conference. And I started chatting with a guy who was packing books up at his booth. And I did not know who he was, didn't even notice what the booth was. We just were commiserating about how much our feet hurt and how tired we were and how glad we were that the conference was over. And as you do, of course, you start talking about, well, who are you and what do you do? And I started to tell him a little about my manuscript. And when I got to the point where I said, half of the book takes place in Las Vegas, he said, I think you should send that to me. He said, do you know, look up there. And he pointed up to the banner of his booth and it said University of Nevada Press.
Wow.
And of course, you know, I wanted to smack myself on the forehead like, you dummy, why haven't you sent it to them yet? And the truth was, I was just starting to send it out to university presses, and I just hadn't developed a good enough list yet. And it turned out that was Justin Race, who's the director of the press, and that was late February, and by late March, they made an offer, which was wonderful.
Wow, and then they were able to turn it around in just over a year.
Yeah, and I guess you know somewhat of what the process is with the university press. I mean, you sign a contract, but then they send your manuscript out to a bunch of peer reviewers who are other, in my case, would have been other memoir authors, and they get all the feedback from them. You're presented with this feedback, and then you write a response letter that says, you know, yes, I'll make these revisions. No, I won't make those revisions. And then the editorial board of the press actually votes on whether they're going to continue to go forward with your manuscript and contract. So there's this like 6-7 week period where you're sort of in limbo. It's yeah. like they say they want to publish your book, but you're waiting on all this feedback and approval. And so fortunately, it went through no problem. But that's one of the unique things about working with a university press.
Mm. And so what's it been like for you? You submitted this, you know, over a year ago. There's that peer review process, and you know went through and made whatever final corrections you needed however many months ago. And now it's like the book is back. It's in your hands. It's bound. It's paper, you know, it's in your hands, and you're now getting ready to share this story with a greater public. So what's it been like for you to sort of bring the story back out from where it was, you know, in on your hard drive and so forth, to now talk about it with people like me and countless others? So how's that? How have you been processing that?
It's very strange, I must say. And in fact, I even had a moment earlier in our discussion here where you mentioned something that you read in the book. And for a moment, I had this flash in my mind of like, how does he know that? I'll tell you this funny little story. When I got a box of the advanced reader copies back in December, you know, which are the ones that they send out to reviewers and that sort of thing. And it's your book bound, but of course it has mistakes in it and whatnot. Anyway, when I was opening the box of books, my son was standing there. He's 24. And the first thing I said when I saw the box, when I saw the book was, oh my gosh, my name's on the cover. Which is the stupidest thing to say, of course. But that's, I guess, just an example of how surreal the experience is, for me anyway, with the first book. You know, I'm sure people who've published many, many books, you know, don't have that reaction. But it's a little odd, you know, to think that every once in a while somebody will say something to me about something they, you know, people who've already read it, because I, you know, give, you know, some of the advanced reader copies to some people, and you know, they would tell me something about my father from the book, and I'd think, did I really say that? Did I let that little secret out? And indeed I did.
Oh man. Well, it's great. I think it should be widely lauded as a great story, very touching and loving, and the conversations that you had with your father, and then the ongoing ones you have, you know, with his quote unquote ghost. Is just a great testament to how when people pass, they don't really die. They stay with us for forever. Whether that's people, that's pets, that's anyone who's lost anyone who's important, they stay with you. And to read those conversations that you had and have is just a testament to the how we process the loss of loved ones. And I think you've done a marvelous job here, and I can't wait. And I wish you great success with this book, Lisa.
Oh, thank you so much, Brendan. That's very lovely. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. So, where can people, you know, find the book and find, maybe get more familiar with you and your work?
Well, if you want to go to my website, it's lisaromeo.net. Real easy to find, and all the buy links are over there. You can get it at all of the major and minor online book retailers. And I love IndieBound. I'll give a little plug for IndieBound. If you don't have a local independent bookstore near you, but you like the idea of supporting independent bookstores, if you go to IndieBound and you put in the name of the book, it will route it to a local independent bookshop to sell it to you through. And it would be lovely if folks wanted to feel like doing this, if they went into their local bookstore and say, hey, I heard about this great book called Starting with Goodbye. Why don't you order some for the store? That would be really dandy.
Nice. And where can people, are you on Twitter or Instagram, Facebook?
I'm all over the place.
Okay, great.
I'm on Twitter at Lisa Romeo. I'm on Instagram at Lisa Romeo Writer. On Facebook, I have an author page on Facebook. It's called Lisa Romeo Author. So, and I love to connect with people, love to hear from people. There's a email contact form on my website, and I read them every day. It's really fun. So I'd love to hear from folks.
Awesome. All right. Well, Lisa, thank you so much for carving out some time in your morning here. Again, great, wonderful job with the book, and I wish you continued success. So we'll be in touch. There it is. First week of two episodes in the bank, and I'm still alive, though just barely. Thank you for listening, and thanks to Lisa for sharing her story and strategies. Head over to BrendanO'Mara.com for show notes and to sign up for my monthly reading list newsletter. It's a growing list. It's pretty cool. Operative word is monthly. I send out my reading recs along with what you might have missed from the world of the podcast. You can even ask for my new CNF Pod zine. Issue number one is out. As you can imagine, the wife does not get it. Also, if you leave an honest review on iTunes and send me a screenshot of it, I will coach up a piece of your writing of up to 10 pages or about 2,000 words. 10 double space pages. Let's keep it reasonable. Times New Roman, no other funky fonts. That's not reserved for 5-star reviewers. You can leave a 2-star review and I'll still honor the deal. Though if you made it this far, you likely think the show has more than 2 stars worth of value, but whatever. These are the things that move the meter in the podcast-o-sphere. So those are deeply appreciated. I'm tired, and I gotta go to work. I'll see you next week, or you'll see my skeletal remains on the ground. See ya!